The next case is 07-1718, Keith and Noel Brown versus William, Richard Levin, Tax Commissioner. Mr. Cohen.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court, my name is Michael Cohen. I have with me my partner, Steve Piggott. We're from the Cavage Famlo Law Firm in Cleveland. We have the privilege of representing Mr. Keith Brown and his late wife, Noel. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Watch your time there.
There are two parts to our case. Procedural part is easy. I refer to it as NDNH, which is no discovery, no hearing. We were entitled to discovery under the BTA rules. Tax commissioner refused to answer it. The BTA ordered the tax commissioner to answer our discovery. The tax commissioner ignored us. We were entitled to a mandatory hearing under the Ohio Revised Code. They refused to give it to us.
And that would be true even if the BTA determines the only matter to be decided is a purely legal issue based on our prior case?
Yes. Because they've acted as the judge and the jury and made that conclusion.
Okay. You're entitled, even if that is their view, that this is a purely legal matter, you believe you're entitled to discovery and to a hearing?
Yes, sir. The substantive part of our case relates to addressing this court's decisions in the Neust and Lovell case. I'll focus on the Neust case because that was the root of this issue. The Neust case basically said two things. It said from the moment the ESBIT statute was passed by the federal government, it was clear from that moment on, crystal clear, that the ESBIT provisions were subordinate to the grantor trust provisions of the Internal Revenue Code. That case said that despite the fact that the ESBIT was the newer statute, the ESBIT was the more specific statute, and despite the fact that the Internal Revenue Code had not applied that federal law in that manner for almost 4 years. The second thing that the Neust case said was that the federal regulation that was passed effective 12/29/2000 did not change anything. All it did was confirm the law as it had already existed. We will show that federal regulation changed everything. Prior to that regulation, it was perfectly acceptable to the IRS for an ESBIT to file a federal trust income tax return. After that regulation, it was no longer proper for a trust to file a federal trust income tax return. It couldn't have been a more dramatic change.
And your trust went out of existence?
Our facts, I understand this is the third case here.
Yeah.
Our facts are perfect facts. We would have preferred to have been first, but we weren't. We have clear facts and clear arguments, and we believe we can demonstrate
that you're different.
The invalidity of the Neust reasoning.
Are you arguing that we need to overturn those cases and that they were wrongfully decided, or that your case is distinguished?
Our case is distinguished on the facts because we are the only one of these cases that did not fall under the new federal regulation. But unfortunately for us, in the way the Neust case is written, you cannot distinguish us only on the facts. You will have to adjust the reasoning in the Neust case.
The distribution out of the trust was made before the tax year, am I right?
Yes, sir, everything.
And under the federal regulations, that was not taxable, if I understand your argument.
That's correct. Everything with this trust was completed before 12/29/2000. So this regulation never impacted us.
So what was the basis of, well, it was exempt from federal tax. What was the basis of the tax commissioner's determination that it was subject to tax in Ohio?
Well, actually, it was not exempt from federal tax, Your Honor. In order to be an ESBIT, you elected that status, and the IRS accepted it. You were required to file federal trust income tax return and pay tax at the federal level at the highest individual rate applicable at that time, which was 39.5%. From dollar one, you did not get the benefit of a graduated rate. The reason that this situation exists is because there were four factors that came into play. Number one, you had, in the late 90s, no one wanted to be a C corporation. Everybody wanted to be an S, but the rules were restrictive. So the IRS liberalized the rules in many, many respects, one of which was to allow trusts to be shareholders. Prior to that time, only one type of trust could be a shareholder in an S corporation, and it was so limited it was useless. The other policy decision was that millions of Americans were doing estate planning and succession planning and entering into what are commonly known as AB trusts. Many of those same Americans owned privately held companies, and they wanted to put the stock of those companies into their trust, but they couldn't because they weren't eligible to be shareholders in an S corporation. Those were the two factors at play at the federal level. At the state level, there were also two factors. One was Ohio did not tax trusts. That's not right or wrong. It's not good or bad. It's a fact. From the beginning of time, actually until 2002, Ohio did not tax trusts. The Ohio individual income tax return starts with, on line one of your return, federal adjusted gross income. So when at a federal level you report your income on a trust return, it doesn't go on your federal individual return. Therefore, it never hits your Ohio individual return. And the byproduct of this was that because Ohio didn't tax trusts, this income was not being taxed. And that's what bothered the tax commissioner. So if I could just turn to why NUST is incorrect. I look at it like a four-lane highway. On lane one, you have the NUST statement, which was the law was clear from day one. And if that's an answer to a problem, which in effect it was, I would work backwards like a math problem and try to see if it proves out when you work it backwards. And lane two is this proof, which I will demonstrate. Demonstrate it shows that the NUST decision is incorrect. Lane three is the actual code-based argument that the Attorney General presented to try to convince you that the answer was clear. I call it the Da Vinci Code, because after 4 years of what the tax commissioner considered a dilemma, an assistant attorney general came up with this theory, and what they said was, we found the clues and the puzzles and the riddles deeply embedded in the Internal Revenue Code, which no one can understand anyway, and they led us to a revelation. And the revelation is that despite the fact that they didn't know what to do with this for 4 years, the revelation was that it was clear from day one. And it was clear from day one, which goes all the way back to 1996, because of the way the ESBIT statute was placed in the Internal Revenue Code. And that's what I will demonstrate incorrect also. The fourth lane is where I would ask your indulgence, because if anyone can understand with confidence and articulate why NUST is correct, that's the only way NUST should stand. I believe that if you look under the surface, that I'm wondering if any of us can articulate with confidence and understanding why the rationale for the NUST case is correct. And the rationale, the NUST case really is a recitation of the Da Vinci Code theory. Here are the proof facts in lane two. You have federal level, state level. Federal level was, it was absolutely clear that prior to 12/29/2000, an ESBIT could file a federal trust income tax return. That is the clearest, most undisputed fact in this case. The regulation that came out from the IRS on 12/29/2000 said that a grantor trust could always elect ESBIT status, which is what the ESBIT provision said in the first place. And the other thing was the IRS regulation that came out could have been, but was not made retroactive. The reason it was not made retroactive was because the IRS recognized that all of these taxpayers, and there were several hundred in Ohio, had followed the proper procedure from a federal standpoint. At a state level, you have the same type of factors. For 3 years, Ohio accepted returns from these taxpayers whose ESBIT income went on a federal trust return and didn't filter down to Ohio, and those returns were accepted without comment or adjustment. Then in 2000, Ohio issued a bulletin, and the bulletin said several things. First of all, it said, there is no federal guidance in this area. And of course, if the Da Vinci Code had been dreamed up at that time, That would have been the federal guidance, but it wasn't. Then it went on to say that a grantor trust cannot elect ESBITs, which of course is directly contrary to the ESBIT statute and is directly contrary to the regulation that eventually came out. And then it said, because of all this, the state of Ohio's position, and that's the exact word, their position is that they can tell someone what the taxpayer can put in its federal adjusted gross income. And during the time all this was going on, there were three bills introduced in Ohio to address this situation. Each bill stated as a preface what the current law was. And none of those bills stated that the law was the Da Vinci Code theory. In fact, they said the opposite. They said that under federal law, an ESBIT pays federal, files a federal trust return, and therefore that income is not filtering into Ohio. And the solution was Ohio should enact a tax on trusts. All those bills failed. The bulletin was a response to those bills. And then there was one more thing that the state of Ohio did. In 2000, they added a new line to the Ohio tax return, which was line 30. After federal adjusted gross income, there are four or five additions to income that you have on your Ohio return. Line 30 is income from an ESBIT. It's the only one that is not supported by a statute. If the Da Vinci Code were correct, then that income, going all the way back to 96 from an ESBIT, would have been on a federal individual return and would have filtered into an Ohio return and been in federal adjusted gross income. So line 30 was another demonstration that the code reasoning advanced in the Noose case was incorrect. Now, line 3 is the actual argument that was presented to you, and I was here listening when it was presented, and I knew the case cold, and I couldn't understand it. It was a hyper-technical tax argument, and in order to follow this, the details are not what's important. It's the concepts that are important. The Internal Revenue Code is divided into categories. You have chapters, subchapters, parts, and subparts. A chapter is the biggest part. The ESBIT statute and the grantor trust statute are in the same chapter. Here's what the Attorney General said the code theory was. Grantor trust rules say that you peel off this ESBIT income and you deem it to be in a separate trust. And then that trust is taxed in accordance with this chapter. The chapter contains the grantor trust rules. The ESBIT statute did not specifically negate the grantor trust rules, and therefore, and here's the fatal flaw, and here's the leap. Therefore, the grantor trust rules trump the ESBIT rules. That is the defect in that reasoning.
Counsel, this is all legal analysis, not factual. Nobody's disputing the facts in this case, correct?
That's correct.
So what would the discovery that you wanted have gotten you?
The discovery would have made it more clear as to why this Da Vinci Code theory was invalid, because we would have discovered things like the IRS wasn't auditing anybody, the IRS's position was that anybody who filed a trust return was doing it properly. The tax commissioner used to work at Price Waterhouse. He just changed teams. They used to do ESBITs. I mean, we would have found admissions. We would have probably found communication from the tax commissioner to the legislatures who introduced these bills, telling them what the law was. It would have made it easier for us to demonstrate the invalidity of the new decision. The Da Vinci Code is debunked. Very simply, the ESBIT was the more specific. The ESBIT was the more recent. The introduction to the ESBIT says, for purposes of this chapter, this is what happens.
Counsel, if we agree with you on the procedural matters, that's the end of it, isn't it?
If you remand us back, then we start over and try again.
Is that what you want?
That's my second choice. My first choice is a reversal. But the ESBIT statute contains limitations on who can elect, specifically. And those requirements to be an ESBIT are, in effect, the exclusions. And those exclusions don't mention grantor trusts. So The Esbit rule, under every rule of statutory construction, the Esbit statute either prevails over the grantor trust rules or it's a standoff. And in either case, it's a win-win for the taxpayer, because in a standoff, the taxpayer wins based on statutory construction. In a normal statutory construction analysis, the Esbit rules would prevail. And the federal regulation confirmed all of this when it specifically did not make the new rules retroactive back into the prior years. And they could have done that, especially if they considered it an abuse, which is perhaps what the Ohio Tax Commissioner felt it was. But as I said, it was a byproduct of federal legislation. It's something that happens every day when practitioners form corporations under Ohio law, and then later they elect S status. Electing S status completely changes the way that that entity and the owners of the entity are taxed. And that's exactly what happened with the Esbit. The federal government passed this rule to make an election. When that election was made, it changed the way the money flowed onto the tax returns, and the only reason it wasn't taxed in Ohio was because Ohio didn't tax trusts.
You have used your time, Mr. Cohan.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hubbard.
May it please the court, my colleague didn't mention explicitly this court's decision in Lovell v. Levin, which is the second case involving this issue, the first one being Knust, or Knust v. Wilkins. In the second case, which was a consolidation of five cases, like in this case, the assertion is that the taxable year of the trust, this is for the 2000 tax year, the assertion is that the trust closed, it was terminated prior to the end of that year. That was also the situation in several of the consolidated cases in Lovell. So the facts are no different. I believe my colleague said that his is the better case, or it should have gone first, but actually the facts are exactly the same as in the Lovell versus Levin case that was decided last term. I might add also that when Knust was before this court, there were about 150 taxpayers who had filed, and I believe Mr. Cohen also referred to that. That's correct. But what he didn't say is that virtually all of those taxpayers following the Knust decision dismissed their appeals. There were a handful who didn't, and those were the five cases that Mr. Vestfall and Lovell, there were two Lovells, and there were two other taxpayer couples involved. So essentially what we're left with is this court has decided this issue with respect to all these other taxpayers, most of whom read the Knust decision and found that to be dispositive, a few of which still continued on and filed, and that was the Lovell versus Levin. And then we have the Browns situation here. So this is essentially the last case. It would be kind of paradoxical if somehow the court were to say, yeah, they're right, and everybody else tough luck because they've already lost.
Am I correct that to get to where he wants, we really have to reverse both of those cases?
Absolutely, Your Honor.
I don't see a distinguishing factor. It's a black or white. You either are right or wrong, and those have to be reversed. Am I correct in that assessment?
Yes, Justice Stratton. In fact, I think most revealing of that is in their briefs. They filed their initial brief prior to Lovell versus Levin. Our brief as appellee pointed out that there were no factual differences. They chose not to file a reply brief. We actually moved for summary affirmance, which was denied, but in that process we noted the facts weren't different, and in their response they just claimed the facts were different, but they never said why. So they've never even identified, and in fact they said before this court earlier that there were no factual distinctions. And that's a correct characterization.
Mr. Hubbard, I think Mr. Cohan argues to us that there was no discovery and no hearing held, and he's claiming, at least in response to Justice Pfeiffer's question, it would be his second favorite outcome. What would be wrong with sending this back and letting discovery go forward and having a hearing on this matter?
Well, Your Honor, actually, there are no relevant facts. There's no facts that are reasonably, there's no evidence that was asked of us. And Mr. Cohen did identify what it was. First of all, he wanted statements that we might have gotten from hearsay from the IRS.
Okay. Before we get into that, we obviously don't know the course of discovery, what interrogatories might be submitted, what depositions might be requested. It's just the opportunity to have that.
Well, Your Honor, there was a show cause order issued, and there was an opportunity pursuant to that show cause order to present what they intended to show. And they set forth what they intended to show, and on the basis of that, because it had nothing to do with the relevant facts of this case, the board decided, just like in a motion in limine, there could have been a hearing. They go to present
this
stuff.
Is there a stipulation of what it would have been that the court could have considered, or the board?
Your Honor, there was a motion, there was an order to show cause, and pursuant to that, both parties filed memoranda. And in that memoranda, they set forth what they believed why the case should not be affirmed. Basically, what the board did is, after the Canoose decision was issued, the board sent to both parties this show cause order, and they said to the appellant, please show why we should not affirm on the basis of Canoost. And in response, they did not present any factual record that would make any difference between Canoost and their case. All they said was, we want to show that the commissioner was behind these bills to clarify the existing law. And that is, the commissioner actually, there was legislation, and certainly the commissioner was involved in it, that expressly set forth that the ESBIT income is passed through to the beneficiary.
The claim was that Ohio didn't tax trusts. Is that true or not?
That was true at the time, Your Honor.
At what time?
At the time for this year, the 2000 tax year. And then subsequent to that, trusts generally became subject to tax.
At this taxing time in 2000, Ohio did not tax trusts.
That's right.
But the outcome of this case is that Ohio collected tax for that trust.
Well, actually, what we did, Your Honor, is we said that the trust is a pass-through entity, a grantor trust, where the grantor and the beneficiary are the same. For federal income tax purposes, those are pass-through entities, and that makes a lot of sense. If you're the grantor and the beneficiary, you are essentially one and the same. And
so
that's what the IRS...
So Mr. Cohan's argument that Ohio doesn't tax trust, you agree with that, but
yes.
Nonetheless, Ohio collected the tax out of the trust.
No, that's not... I don't agree with the second
point. As a pass-through entity.
What we did is the federal income tax code says that the income is exempt at the trust level and passes through to the grantor, okay, the grantor slash beneficiary. So it's never taxed at the federal level, and that's the way it's always been. There's no conflict, there's no trumping of one section and another. What I said before this court in the Canoose case was that Section 641 incorporates by, that's the ESBIT, that's how income is treated with respect to a trust that holds subchapter S shares. That's an ESBIT trust. That section refers directly to the other sections of the code. And the other sections of the Internal Revenue Code include the grantor trust provisions. And there were regs under the grantor trust provisions that were in effect that said the grantor trust is a pass-through entity. The income is not taxed at the grantor trust level. It's taxed to the beneficiary.
And Mr. Hubbard,
Was this done in the years prior to 2000 then as well?
What, Your Honor, what was done?
Well, if I understand your argument about the year 2000, Ohio didn't have a taxing mechanism because trusts weren't taxed. And you said that they collected it because it was a pass-through entity.
Right.
You've explained that to us.
Well,
was that done in 99, 98, 97, 96?
What happened before the 2000 tax year is not in the record.
Well, Mr. Cohan represented to us that in the three prior years there wasn't any tax collected and this was a change
that's
in
what
2000.
That's what he's saying, and in fact that may be the case. But the fact is that the language of the statute is clear, and we don't know to what extent taxpayers were availing themselves of this mechanism. One of the problems we have, Your Honor, is that if a taxpayer doesn't report this income, it's awfully difficult for the commissioner to find it.
Counsel, if they had not paid it in the previous years, would that be relevant?
No, absolutely not.
Mr. Hubbard, I'm trying to get to the understanding. It sounds like this is a new legal challenge to something that we recently decided. And the argument that the grantor trust rules and the ESBIT rules are in the same section of the code, did I just hear you disagreeing with that statement?
What I said, Your Honor, is that the Section 641C, which sets forth how income from a trust that holds Subchapter S shares shall be treated, refers directly for purposes of how the income is to be treated to the other sections of the revised code, and that would incorporate the grantor trust provisions, which are 671 through 679. And this court's decision in both Lovell v. Levin and Canoes v. Wilkins sets forth that extremely well.
Was that addressed in our previous oral arguments?
Absolutely.
All right. Because the idea that the ESBIT rules are more specific than the grantor trust rules seems to have some interest.
Well, Your Honor, if you look at it, it's not a question of conflict. It's not a question of one trumping the other. The ESBIT statute, which is newer, refers to the other sections. Okay. In other words, what it does is it provides that the general treatment of trust income shall be what you apply, except for certain exceptions that are limited. They're set forth in 641 subsection C. And those exceptions don't apply here. They don't assert that they do. So the general provisions of the code are actually incorporated by reference. And that's all that the regulation that this court relied on is reinforcing the statute. That's all that it does is it references those other sections that are incorporated by reference already. This Da Vinci Code thing is amazing. In their brief, they don't even review any of the statutory text. If they did, it's very straightforward. It's a plain meaning of the statute analysis. And with respect to the discovery issue, there's no factual point here, and that's what the board held. The taxpayer had every opportunity, and they were provided with notice to set forth what their basis was, and the board rightly said, there are no facts to discover here. The relevant facts are that this is an ESBIT, that is, that it's a trust that holds shares of an S-corp, and that it's a grantor trust. Those are the relevant issues, factual inquiries. Those are the pertinent facts. And this court has said that very strongly twice now. And, frankly, what the commissioner wrote in his information release was, if a taxpayer doesn't pay it, it's fraud. So this idea that we said this is kind of a puzzling thing, no. The commissioner said this is so clear that it's fraud if you do what they did. They didn't disclose the fact that this was an ESBIT and that they had this income. They just didn't report it. It's not like the first taxpayer here, Canoost, that actually filed a refund claim, so it was flagged. These people tried to get away with it. And it's a lot of money. It's like $1.5 million for 1 year. If there's any other questions, I'd be glad to entertain them.
Is there some reason the tax commissioner didn't respond to the board's order to produce discovery?
Your Honor, I'm glad you asked that. What actually happened is the commissioner moved to hold the case on inactive status pending the decision in Noost, okay? And we did that in every case. There were 150 cases. All other 150 cases, the board granted it. This one examiner at the board didn't, all right, initially. And then Canoes comes out. And then the board issues the show cause order. All through that time, I'm communicating with them. I was the counsel of record below in this case. And we agreed to defer it pending a resolution of the show cause order. So we're talking about that, all right? And it's all oral communications with the board examiner. This board examiner then comes to the conclusion, just like in all the other cases, that it's appropriate to find that the relevant facts are already there. There's no what they're asking for is not relevant. So then they advise the taxpayer that they're not going to require the commissioner to comply. And if you look at the order that is in the record in this case, you'll see it's we moved to put on an inactive status. And what they said is, if you grant that, we'd still like to have discovery. And initially what the board said is, yeah, proceed with discovery. But they never filed a motion to compel. They never did anything like that. Instead, they just waited for the order to come out that affirmed on the basis of Canoost. So this was, and again, you got to remember, we have 150 cases. Everybody else is waiting for Canoost to come out. When it comes out, virtually everybody dismisses after that. So, I mean, yeah, maybe we could have done it a little better and had some letters going to and from, but frankly, I mean, we have
counsel
lots of stuff.
Counsel, of the 150 cases that were waiting for our decision in Canoost, were any of them, is this case before us, the Brown case, factually different, or you said, I remember in the news case, they paid it and they asked for a refund. Here, they didn't pay it, they didn't disclose it, they thought this is trust money, so we don't have to pay tax on it, and they didn't attribute to their personal income. Are there any of the other 150 cases that did the same thing and then ended up fessing up, so to speak, and paying the tax?
Your Honor, the first case was a refund case. A few, if you look at the level of 11, some of those were refunds, some of them were assessments. The assessments, basically, what I was saying is that we identified that they hadn't paid the tax in some way, and so we issued an assessment. They haven't paid that yet. So they haven't paid the tax yet. They okay, haven't so paid there, the state there, income tax.
Of the 150, there were other assessment cases,
oh,
not just refund requested cases.
And if you look at the record in level of 11, well, actually the appendix, I attached all the decisions where they were assessments and refunds. And like I think it breaks down like most of them were assessments, but there were, you know, several refunds. And I can't remember what the breakdown is. It might be 80-70.
I just wanted to make sure that Mr. Brown's case is not so totally factually unique that we need to take that into consideration.
Absolutely not, Your Honor. That would make no difference whatsoever in interpreting the plain meaning of the statute. You know, we're asking to apply the plain meaning of the statute. Whether it's an assessment or a refund claim shouldn't have any bearing on that. That's what I would say. Well, thank you for your
thank you, Mr. Hubbard.
Time and attention.
Mr. Cohan, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
I'd like to address the fact issues. In both the Neust and Lovell cases, facts were mentioned. There are two critical facts. One was the trust terminated before 12/29/2002. Was a tax return filed for a year ending prior to 12/29/2000. In the Browns case, both of those things occurred. In the prior cases, they made a mistake on one of those or the other. Either they terminated after the fact and tried to make it retroactive, or they filed a tax return for a period ending after 12/29/2000. What they've done in the news case is take you into tax quicksand, and what has emerged is a decision that is not factually supportable and not intellectually supportable. The grantor trust rules are in the same chapter. That is the basis of their argument. There is a conflict between those provisions, and in the worst case for the taxpayer wins the tie. The grantor trust provisions do not say what Mr. Hubbard says they say. They say the tax is applied according to the chapter, not according to the grantor trust rules. There was an inherent conflict, and that's why the IRS did what it did, which was to resolve the issue from that point forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cohan. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.